Well, I must say it is good to be here, and it's good to see so many of my old friends here and some new friends too. Oh my goodness, hi. Everybody got cushions? Enough cushions? There's more cushions here. Good to see you, I'll tell you. Yes, 5.5 months in hospital. And just kind of adjusting to being out. Feeling the environment slowly. And feeling my body in relationship to the environment. Okay. So this is a teaching that is based on a book that I have been trying to write now for 2 or 3 years. And the book is called The Cost of Illusion. And I hope that you will find this teaching interesting. I find it very interesting. You're putting it together and really seeing how to express these ideas, which are not so easy. And we may have heard these ideas before, but I think for most of us, it's just over the top of our head. So how to simplify things and be able to communicate these ideas in a way that's really practical. This is the important thing. If we don't know how to practice, then we don't know how to apply these ideas to our life. So it just remains something, you know, remote. It's like reading a book, and then you put it down, and that's it. But these teachings are about life. These teachings are about the way we see life, about our own perception, about how our senses work, how our feelings work. You know, what makes up the way we see life. I mean, how many of you have ever questioned this? I just experience. But what makes up experience? How do you know what you experience is true? Has any basis to it or not? We don't question. So here, we're going to question. We're really going to go into things and also, we're going to be given something that we can really practice, hopefully. And then it is internalized. These teachings are internalized. And that's what it's about. Because unless you internalize these teachings, you don't change the way you see things. So, I always start off my teachings for the last few years in Brazil. Every teaching I start off and I say the same things, and I just say, you cannot experience anything in your life unless your mind interprets it to be a certain way. Now think about this. There is nothing that you can experience unless your mind tells you that you are experiencing something. So what does that mean? It means that your mind is the source of all your experience. There is nothing happening externally that is happening independent of your own mind. Now try and think about this logically. Now we think that things go on around us, and they just happen, you know. The trees are like this, the flowers are like that, this person is like this, this situation's like that. And we really believe that is the way it is. Whatever we're thinking, that is the way it is. Well, is it? Is it really that way? This is what we're questioning. Is it really the way we think it is? How many of you believe in what you think? Hands up. Where do your feelings come from? What makes you react to things in certain ways? First of all, what do you need in order to have a reaction about anything? Just consider that. You know, what makes you react?
Conditioning.
Hmm?
Conditioning.
Conditioning. What's conditioning?
Learned patterns, how you behave.
Learned patterns, yes. Learned ideas. This is good, because this is bad, because all your reference points that make it a certain way. Now, if you didn't believe in what you think, would you react? Anybody? If you didn't believe a person was a certain way, would you react to them? No, you wouldn't. You wouldn't have desire for that person or aversion to that person or that situation. You just wouldn't. Because you wouldn't believe in what you think. You'd understand it's just a thought. And thoughts come and go. So what's our problem? Our problem is that we cannot be detached from our own thought process. As soon as the thoughts come up, immediately, we just, that's it. That's the way it is. We've never really examined the thought process. We've never examined the components of our own experience. And this is what confusion is about. This is what we talk about in Buddhism. Being confused, because we just do not see the actuality of what is happening moment by moment. We just don't see. We just see what we think is happening moment by moment. So this is our motivation. You know, we hopefully we're here to work with our own confusion, because now what we do is we share our confusion with everybody. Everybody we meet, we share our ideas about this and that. This is like this, that's like that, this person's like this, this and that, da 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 da. And so we perpetuate confusion. So now if we work with the way we see life, and slowly we remove these filters of conditioning, then of course, not only do we benefit ourselves, but we benefit others, because we don't share our confusion with others. We share less and less confusion with others. Think about how it works. This is compassion. This is what we mean by compassion in Buddhism. Compassion comes from wisdom. It comes from seeing. Seeing things as they are, not how you think they are. Does it make sense? Think about it for a few moments. Does it make sense or not? What do you think confusion is? What do you think ignorance is? Ignorance is not stupid. Ignorance is very intelligent. It makes you ignore the actuality. Clever. Is that somebody there at the door? Please come in. We've got more cushions here. You can come and sit right in the front if you dare. Everybody's always moving back. Come in, Lizzie. There's a cushion right there. Now, before we go on, we have to understand this, otherwise the rest of the teaching's not going to make sense. So let's go over this idea in the beginning. We cannot experience anything in our lives unless our mind tells us what we are experiencing, that we are experiencing something. Anybody disagree with this? Think about it and tell me how you feel about that.
Suppose I'm just walking along the road and a car runs over my foot. Just an example. I won't have thought about that, it would catch me by surprise. How is that not independent of my mind?
No, but you need your mind to interpret it. You know, that is a car. And that has run over my foot. Even that mental labeling. Yeah, somebody who wouldn't know what a car was wouldn't know. Yeah, but that was a car going over their foot. They might say it was something else. So everything is labeled mentally.
Annie, I'll speak it and I'll see her.
Yeah, that's right.
Before I felt the itching, before I labeled mosquito bitten, I already had an adverse reaction to the itching.
Yes, that's right.
So I don't have to label it mosquito, all I have to label is itching, is that right? And then that's...
No, we're going to go through this. We're going to see the whole sequence of how it all fits together. But it's so fast. These seeds in our subconscious, what we call the storehouse consciousness, every seed of our experience is there, and then they come to the surface through all these filters, and immediately, so fast, they're interpreted, attachment, aversion, this, and then we build up.
I agree with what you're saying almost fully, but not entirely, because I think, like in Sarah's example, the system is wired to feel pain because it increases survival. If you didn't feel the pain, you could do yourself even more harm. So pain serves a function that bypasses the critical factor of the conscious mind. So I think there are situations where interpretation comes after the fact. But for the most part, in how we operate in the world, I think it is interpretation first, even though that may happen in a nanosecond.
It's a nanosecond,
and then you have a physical reaction.
Yeah, we're going to look at feeling, how it works in detail. But there's the physical side of feeling, and of course there's the mental side of feeling. How many of us actually just experience pain? No. Pain is relative to something.
Well, what I'm saying is people who do not experience pain at all are seriously at risk of severe harm, in fact, they're at risk of death. So the feelings of pain, the sensory perception of pain, serves as a survival mechanism.
I don't agree with you, because you have these masters who are really very awakened, and the way that they experience things is very different than the normal person. They are very detached from these ideas that we call pain. Very, very detached. They don't experience things in the same way. You don't have to see things that way. You could see things in another way. You're still not going to walk in front of a car. But that, it doesn't mean to say that, it's just, we'll go into it slowly. I don't fully agree with you. Let's see how it works. Yeah.
And do you include dreams in the domain of experiences? And if so, what function, then mind is still to apply to the experience.
Yes, very much so. The way that we experience things now is very much like a dream. But we don't see it that way. Because why don't we see it that way? What makes a dream, and this not a dream? Anybody? What's the difference?
I'm not sure it's exactly to the point, but at the moment, all of us here are, if we're immersed in an illusion, we're immersed in the same illusion, that we are here, that there's a certain environment that we are participating in. We could, one from the other, come to a fairly substantial agreement on that, on the details of that illusion. So I wonder how we're sharing something that isn't, that is within ourselves rather than external to ourselves.
Yeah, we have an expression. I don't usually use a lot of Buddhist expressions. I don't think it's necessary, but this is very useful. We have what we call collective karma and individual karma, which means collective conditioning and individual conditioning. So we all seemingly think that we're in a room in Pakok, or if we know it's Pakok, then it would be Pakok. If we think this is a room, then it's a room, and we all agree. This is Pakok, this is a room, this is Hong Kong, this is that. And then individually, we all experience things in a very different way. So coming in here, you may like what you see. And that might want to make you come back again. Or you may be threatened by the imagery. Yeah. And think, no, I don't want anything to do with this. I don't like this. I prefer, you know, something more simple. Yeah. Or whatever it is. And so these filters come up so quickly that then make you see things in a certain way. Either you like it or you don't like it. If you like something, then you want more of it. If you don't like something, then you push it away from you. You don't want to deal with it. It appears to you as something threatening. Same room, same person. Yeah. There's people, there's many people, you know, who just see me and immediately they don't want anything to do with me because of these clothes and the hairstyle, and they have so many ideas that they just don't want to even, you know, approach. And there's other people who are attracted by the haircut and the funny clothes. Yeah. Same person. So why? You know, what makes us see things so differently, experience things so differently, that one side we have incredible pleasure and the other side we have incredible pain from the same appearance? Now, I'm not going to use object here. I'm not going to use the word object. I'm going to use the word appearance. Phenomena appear to us in certain ways. Now, we're going to look at the conditions that are needed for phenomena to appear to us in those specific kinds of ways. What conditions are necessary to really help us to experience things?
You seem to still be speaking objectively as if there's something separate to ourselves out there.
Appearances.
So that's not disputed.
No, I'm saying there's nothing objectively out there. Everything depends on conditions. If you take away the conditions, then there is nothing objective. But if you depend on the conditions, then because there's a subject, there will be an objective world. There's something here, perceiving something out there. If you understand that, it's okay. One side depends on conditions, and the other side, it just cannot appear to be that way without those conditions. You understand? One side, you see how the conditions make you see a certain way. And when you take away those conditions, it just is impossible to see that way.
I'm getting a little confused between the two examples. But on the one hand, we have one mind, you could say, interpreting things. And you're saying there's nothing external to the mind which interprets.
Yes.
Then, in a collective sense, you're starting to talk about, you know, the mind interprets this outer phenomena differently. Like, one person has aversion, one person has attachment.
Because...
But that still sounds, when you speak that way, it sounds like you're actually affirming that there is something external to those minds that they're interpreting.
No, my language. Excuse my language. Then I have to really be careful here that we use appearances. We forget about using the word objective. Let's try just using appearances. How phenomena appear to us.
Could you define appearance?
Yes,
in the way that you're using it.
How anything appears to us.
Still sounds like there's something external.
I think we have to go on. Then we'll see how it works.
Is an appearance unique?
Unique. Only to the individual person. Yeah.
At that moment.
And then it changes as your thoughts about it change. So the appearance also changes. If I put red lenses in my glasses, then the world will appear as red. If I change the lenses and put green in, then the world appears as green. So it's not, doesn't depend on the world as such, this idea of the world, but it depends on the type of lenses, the type of conditioning that makes me see things in certain ways. That's the meaning of appearance. What phenomena, what conditions are necessary for that phenomena to appear that way? No, still not happy.
It's just the language.
It's the language.
There's limitations in the language, I understand that. I'm just trying to clarify that.
Yes.
But it's still a projection, even if it's being projected by multiple people.
Yes, it's still a projection.
So you're not even affirming that there's quote-unquote light energy
out there, or
colors, or anything like that. I mean, that all is all a label as well, but there's no affirmation of that whatsoever.
No.
So in one way, it's a complete negation. You're saying there is nothing there. No, there's...
No, that's even an idea.
Right, I mean, but...
No, you can't even have that.
Right.
What happens to relative reality as opposed to...
No, this is what we're talking about now. First of all, we have to understand...
Relative.
This is conditioning. Relative is conditioning. Relative is, there is high because there's low. Otherwise, there's no high. There's good because there's bad. It doesn't exist individually. It's all relative.
Yeah, but that old analogy, if you stand in front of a car, whether it's real or not, it's going to be sent you to hospital.
Yeah, but we're talking about how we interpret the situation of what's going on. It's very hard for us to let go of this idea that there's something there.
Yes, I think I understand what you mean by interpretation. What I'm having trouble with is what Woody has been developing, and that is that there's nothing out there, because if there's nothing out there, if a car hits you, you wouldn't go to hospital.
It's not a question of nothing out there.
It's relative, right?
It depends on conditions. It doesn't just exist like that. It depends on conditions to appear to exist. Okay, be patient, Melanie. Just be patient. Don't grab onto the word so quickly. You know, we're trying to understand something that is very subtle here. The actuality and how things appear is very subtle.
Could place, if a car runs over a log, did it happen?
Again, depends. If you take away the thoughts, now take away all the thoughts, did it happen?
I don't know.
There you go. You can't say.
How's that person in the hospital?
No.
But I'm trying to remove the idea of this, you know, what I'm trying to do is pull away the perception of reality from a video that some event for which there's no experience, that does that event actually happen?
Yeah, it depends. It depends. Depends on conditions to understand. I'm not saying that nothing exists. I'm not negating, I'm not saying everything, there's nothing exists. I'm just saying it doesn't exist the way we think it exists. It depends on conditions to appear to exist. It's my language that you're having trouble with.
Then, appearance,
yes.
Normally implies an observer whom the appearance occurs.
That's right.
In which case, would you agree that appearance can be equated to personal experience of the actuality?
Yes.
Appearance is personal experience.
Any kind of appearance must have a perceiver.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
When you take away the perceiver, we're going to look at all the components of what makes us feel that there is something here, perceiving something there. We have to understand that. What conditions are necessary for us to feel that there's something here, perceiving something there? Now we don't understand that. So we're trying to make this huge jump without understanding the conditions that are necessary. All right? Any questions? Graham, I see you shaking your head.
No,
you don't have to agree.
No,
don't, you don't have to agree. I'm just introducing.
How do you interpret the thought? Because interpret always means interpret something. So as soon as you say interpret, you think, what is it you're interpreting? I think that's the problem with what interpret is. You can only interpret something. There's got to be something out there to interpret.
Yeah, true. But what we think is out there could be illusory. It's the problem. We do believe there's something out there. And that's where we kind of get lost. That's what we call the cost of illusion. Because every time you react to something, you believe that it exists in a certain way.
The difference between believing your own interpretation and believing there's something out there.
I think first of all you have to believe there's something out there in order to interpret it a certain way, no?
Yeah. That's wrong. And it's not skillful.
I think it causes problems.
It's hard.
Yes, it's not easy. This is why we need practice, because we are so familiar with seeing an external world. This is how we relate to things. There's something out there. We're bouncing all the time. We're bouncing back from this feeling with attachment and aversion all the time, or indifference. Attachment, aversion, indifference. We categorize everything, and then more and more habitual patterns build up. And we don't even know. You know, the person hasn't said anything, and already we have aversion to the person. Why? What makes us have aversion to the person? Or the situation? Where does it come from?
Having aversion to a person is different from having aversion to pain or itching, it seems to me, anyway.
What? Slowly.
Yeah.
Slowly.
Yeah.
Let's go on. So this is what we're we call confusion, ignorance, not seeing the actuality of phenomena. And then our motivation is to work with our own confusion so that we can not only benefit ourselves, but we can benefit others as well. This makes more sense to me than just telling, you know, I've heard so many times over the years, oh, you must have a positive motivation. You must have a motivation to benefit others, to benefit all beings. Well, how can I benefit all beings? It seems impossible. I can't even benefit myself. How can I benefit others? Yeah. But when I think about working with my own confusion, diminishing my own confusion, then naturally that benefits others. Then I see how it works. I think, yes, of course. Doesn't that seem more flippable? Hmm? Otherwise, you know, it's such a vast, impossible concept, it would seem, to benefit all beings. But if I change my ideas, you know, and then I change the way I see, then of course, yes, I won't have that negativity anymore. I won't see things with aggression. I see things in a more open, flexible way. To be that openness is compassion. But that can only come from wisdom, and wisdom comes from seeing things as they are, not how we think they are all the time. So in Buddhist ideas, you can't have compassion unless you have wisdom, and you can't have wisdom unless you have compassion. There's two sides, one coin. Okay, so let me give you, you've heard this before, but there are eight people here, so I'm just going to talk a little bit about the definition of mind. You know, what do we mean by mind? Can anybody define mind for me? Anybody have a definition of mind?
Instrument of interpretation.
Hmm?
The instrument of interpretation.
Instrument of interpretation.
It's a part of the brain involved in higher mental processes, thinking, planning.
Activity of thought is mind.
The thing that knows.
The thing that knows. The thing that knows.
That which experiences.
Hmm?
That which experiences.
That which experiences. Anybody else? That which experiences.
The ego.
The ego.
That which judges.
Yeah. You'd be amazed. You know, I asked this question in many universities that I teach in. I teach in many, many different universities throughout Brazil. In the psychological department. And the first question I ask is, can you give me a definition of mind? Otherwise it's going to be difficult to go on. And they cannot give me a definition of mind. Interesting.
Yeah.
So, let me give you a definition of mind, and then you can about it.
Why not with a capital M or a small M?
All right. So, that which possesses discriminating awareness, that which possesses a sense of duality, which grasps or rejects something external, this is mind. So that which can associate with other, with any something that is perceived to be different from the perceiver. So that's the definition of mind. So the Tibetan phrase which defines mind, that which can think of the other, that projection is mind. I think this is very, very complex, very subtle. That projection which can think of other is mind. So every time you relate to anything other, so, very specific. It's not just a kind of vague, creepy thing in your head. It's a very specific definition. Very basic, very precise. And what happened is the mind, or the particular nature, is the perception that lingers on something other than oneself. So as soon as there's a tendency just to rest the consciousness, just a little bit, then there's the sense. It solidifies into the idea there's something other than self. That perception is mine.
Well, what about when you're not doing that? What about when you're not doing
that? That's awareness.
That's
awareness, yeah.
So awareness is separate from mind?
No, when we let go of this tendency to always project duality, there's something other than self, yes, then you just relax, and that is that's our fundamental intelligence. That's what we call awareness. But as soon as we rest, the consciousness rests, there's a tendency to objectify, making it into something. And that projection is mind. Without that, there is no such phenomena as mind. Of course, this is one definition. This is the Tibetan Buddhist definition of mind. So mind makes the fact of perceiving something else stand for the existence of oneself. Wow, this is very interesting. Mind makes the fact of perceiving something else stand for oneself. So as soon as we have an object, there must be something to perceive that object. This is how the ego works. So we constantly have to create objects all the time so that we can feel that there's something here, perceiving something there. So it's not created, first there's the subject and then there's the object. It's first there's the object and there's something. Because there's the object, there's something to perceive it. And then we recreate constantly this idea of self by recreating our idea of an objective world. Fascinating. Who would ever think it works that way? Huh? So this is a mental trick that constitutes the idea of mind. So it should be the opposite. I exist, therefore other exists. But it's not that way. It's because other exists, then of course I must exist to perceive it. So we have to constantly keep recreating this illusion that there's this objective world out there. Otherwise the trick falls apart. So we're going to examine the components of our own psychology. And then we'll see we have 8 aspects of consciousness and we have 52 types of conceptions. And this was all, you know, classified 2,500 years ago. That is something. Yeah, this is not something that I just dug up recently. This is Buddhist psychology. This is all bound up in the realm of duality. And the realm of duality is this idea of ego. So we're going to look at how these 8 aspects of consciousness work, how the senses work, where all the seeds of our experience come from, how the filters interpret these seeds and solidify, and then slowly, more and more, we will see all the components that come together. That's why we perceive things in certain ways. If we don't understand why we perceive things in certain ways, then we can't let go of the habit. It's really difficult to let go of these habits of our perception. We always have the tendency to react in certain ways until we see again and again it's not true. It doesn't exist that way. Over and over again. We can't just see it once. We have to be able to familiarize ourselves with another way of seeing. And then everything opens up. There's another possibility. And this is what we do when we meditate. It's familiarizing ourselves with another way of seeing. Until this new way of seeing becomes totally natural. And then we let go of our old habits. But we can't let go of our old habits when that is the way we're conditioning ourselves all the time. Same kind of reaction. So if we want to give this word mind another name, then let's call it ego. Ego and mind are synonymous. Because ego can only function in duality, and mind can only function in duality. You have to have an object to play with. Otherwise, how can you have a self? Think about it. It's very logical. No? Not logical? Come on, play with me.
Transcend ego, there's no mind. Mind and ego are the same.
Yeah, mind and ego. Yeah, it has to have a duality. It has to function. It only functions in duality, mind. Then once you just rest, you know, you rest in that openness. That's fundamental awareness. That's wisdom. It's no longer mind. Mind is this activity that only functions in duality.
Mind is the personal mind. I'm the mind that belongs to me, if it were.
Does it make sense? Remember, it's just a definition. You don't have to accept it. I'm just giving you another way of seeing things. This whole teaching is about seeing things in another way. It's not about morality. It's not about religion. It's not about anything like that. It's just seeing. It's about perception. The way we experience life.
I'm getting confused. And when I asked earlier if you meant by capital M or small m, I wasn't sure. To use terms from New Age, which I'm exposed to.
Yes, I'm not exposed to that.
Okay.
Yeah.
Capital M, mindfully capital M, is almost equated to all that is. Of course, but not Buddhist terms I'm speaking. With the small m, it's the personal mind, which I think you defined just now. And and as such is the source of the problem, the illusion. This mind, the conditioned mind. But I'm wondering if there is another mind bigger than the personal mind. A mind which helps things as they are. Almost a sort of faculty of the personal mind, which is the good mind. I don't know if that's the question.
Again, it depends in what tradition we're coming from. The definitions are used in different ways. So, in Buddhist definition, we don't have the mind with a capital M. Once you go beyond duality, then you go into a realm of openness, awareness. We use that kind of terminology. Then you go into the that openness is wisdom itself. It sees beyond concept. It sees the actuality, not how we think it is, but how it is. So we don't call that mind. But you may, if your definition is similar, then, maybe we're talking about the same thing. We have to be very careful with definitions, not to hold on to things so that we can see from another person's point of view. Maybe we're talking about the same thing.
Would a Buddha's mind be similar to the mind of the cat?
Again, I would have to understand more. It has to include certain things. I think this is a wonderful book to read, what makes you not a Buddhist. Because there's certain components. It's like to be a so-called Buddhist, it's not really, there's no such thing as a Buddhist. But anyway, if we're going to use terminology, we use terminology and we'll say, to be a Buddhist, you have to include certain aspects into your perception. So you have to see everything is changing moment by moment. If you don't see that, then you can't say that you're practicing Buddhism. You have to see everything has no solidity. That means now we make everything substantial through concept. This is a very nice cup. Look at that. Look at the colors, and the dragons and this and that. And we build it. We make it into something solid through concept. So we have to understand that it depends on concept to be that way. And then finally we have to understand that nothing exists independently from our own mind. If we include all those three in our definition of mind, then we could say, yes, that's Buddhism. But if we don't include those three, then you can't say it's the same thing. Mind and awareness is the same thing. Mm.
That's a joke.
Hmm?
That's a joke, because if we did have one, we wouldn't label anything.
So that's what I'm saying. That's
like a riddle.
Yeah, that's right. That's what I'm saying. There's no such thing as a Buddhist.
That's it. As soon as you say that, you've already made a mistake.
Yeah. Yeah, I agree with you. So could you tell me if we're talking about something similar?
Yes, you answered my question. Thank you. I'm a doctor of immunology, I suppose. But Roberta's question was interesting. Buddha's mind, is that related to our discussion or the term Buddha's mind?
No, we don't use it. We don't use that phrase.
Right.
Maybe in Zen you hear sometimes, but many traditions of Tibetan Buddhism, they don't talk about Buddha's mind.
Well, the mind is an enlightened being.
Yes, but when you come down to practice, you don't talk about, you talk about different, you use different terminology. It's all different terminology. Because if we consider mind to be duality, you wouldn't say that the Buddha is still conditioned by duality. Depends on the definition.
If his definition of big mind means like omniscient and
then you can use it.
Then
it's the Buddha's mind, yeah. Yeah. Any questions?
I think there's a difference, though. I mean, I'm not sure about to the man's idea of big mind and the New Age idea and exactly where it comes from. But I think there are a number of traditions, and I think in the Hindu tradition, you have the idea, you clearly have the idea of small mind and big mind, that there's individual consciousness and there's kind of
Brahma consciousness.
But I think that that is actually very different from Rigpa. I think that that's also conditioned mind, even in the Hindu tradition.
Yes,
I think that Rigpa is something very different from that. But I'm not sure where big mind, small mind in Silly Man's tradition comes from. And, yeah.
No, I'm happy with your terminology to clarify the
basic. I think your answer would be more eloquently put if you have a look at that book.
Okay.
Because it makes things very, very clear. Yeah, a wonderful book. I haven't read it yet, but I'm sure it's a wonderful
book. Good work.
That's a very good.
I don't read many books. I've been trying to write my own for years unsuccessfully, because people I think are far more eloquent writers than I am. Okay, well, this teaching usually it's not taught in the way that we usually have our interactive groups. You know, usually at the end I say, anybody have questions? But with us I continue to say, anybody have any questions? So it takes a lot longer to introduce these ideas. Probably, you know, to go through this, it would take us a good 5 weeks. That means from morning to night. Yes. this is just part of it, because it goes into so much detail. It gives you so much clarity of how everything fits together. Yeah, and then you have so much more confidence to apply this to your own practice. It's very, very helpful.
I think I wrote it.
God help your editor.
Hmm?
God help your editor.
God help my editor, yes. That's true. I have many editors and they've all given up. Yeah, you're right, Melanie. Yes. Okay. I feel like a very kind of rusty friend at the moment. You know, I haven't really been teaching like this for quite a while now, so I feel quite rusty.
You've been teaching us another way, that's for sure.
Hmm. Okay. So the mind divides experience into subject and object. First it identifies with the subject, I, and then we go on from there. Then we have the idea of mine, and then we start to cling to my body, and then we start to cling to my mind, and then we start to cling to my name. And then we have this kind of attachment to these ideas which grows stronger and stronger, and then we become more exclusively concerned with our own well-being, because there's my body and there's my mind and my problem. And we tend to exaggerate as soon as this idea of mine comes in. Then of course my problems are, you know, much more serious than your problems. There's the tendency towards this. You know, my pain is, you know, worse than your pain. A wonderful example of this is, you know, if you go into a watch shop and there's another customer there and they are trying on a watch, and then they drop their own watch on the floor and it smashes. You just, you know, there they are, smashed his watch. But if you drop your own watch on the floor and it smashes, there's a very different feeling. Why is there a different feeling?
You have attachment to memories.
Yeah. Right. Because it's mine. My watch, that little thing there, that mine, makes a big difference to the way we see things. And this happens with everything. Yeah? It acts such a powerful filter on our perception. This, my body, my mind, my situation, my problems. So then what happens is we constantly strive for comfort, and our intolerance of life's annoying situations kind of decreases, because you're interfering with my comfort. So anything that annoys me, we become very, very intolerant to. If you have a different view than my view, then, you know, oh, I'm sorry, you know, I really haven't got time, because you don't think the way that I think. Look, you know, the whole point about these teachings is we need to look at the way that we personally react to situations and experiences. What makes us react in certain ways? Why do we get annoyed when somebody has a different view to us?
Because I'm right.
That's it.
And it's hard to take it when people don't appreciate it.
Yeah. Thank you.
Because I'm very the truth.
Hmm?
Two people have got very different opinions of what's happening. And I
Thank you. That's you, everybody. Where's the truth? This is what we've got to find out. Where is the truth? Is there a truth based in concept? Then how does it work? What do you think?